I think that a strong partnership, for me, has been a huge part of the reason I've been successful. And I think by having somebody else alongside you, it becomes a lot easier to catch those mistakes early.
Today, we're joined by Simon Vollmer, founder and CEO of Lighthouse, the digital conveyancy SaaS platform revolutionizing the way that property transactions are handled using AI.
Being in a privileged position of having investors who have backed us and believe in the longer term of the idea, my experience with chat interfaces is that they're a really good way to understand what AI is capable of, but they're perhaps not the right way to solve a specific problem.
From what I've seen is people have varying opinions on AI, a lot of the time based on how well they understand the technology. The
kind of core principles of building of software, I think, again, go back to...
Welcome to another episode of the Worldbot.ai podcast. I'm very excited to be bringing everyone an enlightening conversation today with an outstanding guest. Today we're joined by Simon Vollmer, founder and CEO of Lighthouse, a digital conveyancy SaaS platform revolutionizing the way that property transactions are handled using AI. Simon and the team are doing some really clever stuff at Lighthouse, which we're going to talk about in today's episode. Simon's entrepreneurial journey is very impressive, starting his first business while he was in university, moving on to founding of successful ventures like Black Software and Brand Fiber, and then even giving corporate a go, and after just 2 years, being put in charge of almost 200 people at Datacom. Today we're going to delve into his journey, the innovative work he's doing at Lighthouse, how he sees the AI industry as a whole, and more. Simon, how are you doing today?
Good, yeah, doing very well, thank you. It's nice to be here.
Awesome. Well, it's great to have you on. So I normally like to start these episodes off by giving the viewers a bit of context about who you are, you know, how you got to doing what you are doing now. So you've obviously had a remarkable career as an entrepreneur and in corporate. You've got a bit of everything. So please, can you talk to me a little bit about your journey, how you got into what you're doing and where you are now?
Certainly. Yeah, of course. I'm not sure I'd characterize it as remarkable, but it's certainly been a journey. So I started my first business when I was at university studying commerce and law. Funnily enough, actually went full circle back to the law side of that, but we'll get to it. A friend of mine and I thought we would start small and take on the yellow pages. So we started a small online directory for sort of party supplies, you know, DJs, that kind of thing. As you can imagine, the venture didn't go particularly well, but throughout the course of that, I got quite interested in doing some of the software development myself.
And that
really struck a nerve in me. I think I seem to quite enjoy solving problems and sort of hands on keyboard, being able to do that into the late hours of the evening, really sort of fit me quite well. So after that venture, I continued with my degree, and I thought I'd look for ways to make a bit of money on the side of university, which you're definitely familiar with. and so I started doing a little bit of software development, and really just hours for myself contracting out. Then one day that grew into something a little bit larger. I managed to pick up a rather big contract for a state-owned telco to do a rebrand of their website and do some development for that. And I was extremely underskilled at the time. I sort of was really lacking in the design area, which is kind of one of the core things you need if you're going to be going through a rebrand. So I joined forces with my uncle, and we sort of tackled the project. We won the work and did a sort of really great job on the outcome. So him and I got together and decided to start a brand agency shortly after, Brand Fiber, as you mentioned, where he was the design arm and I was the sort of technical arm doing the development work. It was a really good, that sort of went on for about 3 years. We picked up a good few websites and we did a fair bit of development work, sort of shifting towards the product side, so less just less of just a brochure website. And that was really good for me. I learned a lot about how to appreciate good design and the importance of the role that it plays in building a product, and had a lot of fun. After a couple of years, I decided to go separate ways, and go deeper on the technical side, I suppose. Mm-hmm. So a good mate of mine and I got together and we started a software agency called Black Software, which was really focused on, initially just focused on, you know, building mobile apps and building applications. But over a couple of years, I really developed that interest in the product side of what we were doing. So really getting quite engaged in the roadmaps that our customers were building and making sure that they were delivering value. I think it's very easy as a technologist to get quite excited by, you know, the thing that you're building, the technology behind what you're building. But I sort of really got to enjoy sort of going deeper and why are we building this thing and what might be a better solution to the problem. Mm. So that was great. I had a wonderful experience there. We built that into a company that I think at its peak had about 13, 14 staff. We had a great culture. We all really rallied around the products that we were building and the customers we were working with. I remember fondly lots of moments where I wouldn't call it arguing, but consulting, I guess. we would be quite animated with our customers about sort of the decisions they'd make, and customers seemed to really respond well to it. So. I had a great time there, and then sort of found myself, I suppose, after about 5 years, really struggling to scale the business beyond where I got it to, and having never really had experiences outside of the business, didn't really have a view as to what I needed to do next to grow the business. So I took a bit of a hiatus. I went to Europe, spent a couple of years there, and then came back to New Zealand. Around the start of COVID, which cut my holiday plans a little bit short.
Yeah.
And so when I got back to New Zealand, I was certainly that entrepreneurial bone in my body wanted to go back out and do something of my own. But I thought, why don't I try something a little different and get a bit of experience somewhere else? So I don't know what sort of motivated me to do it, but I made quite a big gambit and applied for a role that was far too big for me at Datacom. But I was very lucky in that the people that I interviewed with sort of saw that maybe there is some opportunity for me elsewhere in the business, and sort of jumped on board at Datacom, which is obviously it's Australasia's largest homegrown tech company. It was a good experience for me getting into the business, very lucky and blessed, as sort of all of my journey has been, to have been given the opportunity. Once I arrived at Datacom, the one piece of advice that I'd been given was treat it like it's your own business. And so I did that, and my journey at Datacom was really, really exciting. I initially started with no team. It was just me focused in that sort of product side of the business that I mentioned before. And then in time, that role sort of grew, and I sort of grew to managing a team of about, I think, about 50 odd in Auckland, and then sort of expanded that to a team of about 70 over the course of a year, and then I got the opportunity to go down to Wellington and to lead the Wellington teams and the South Island teams in software engineering, which was a lot of fun. It was very eye-opening working with government, but also, as you could probably tell with a big step up in team sizes, having to learn all sorts of other skills in terms of managing and growing a business of that scale.
Simon, that is a remarkable career in my opinion. I think you've done really well and you've been involved in so many different aspects of business, from, you know, that startup small business culture where you're contracting work to then going into corporate and managing these bigger teams. And I think it's almost like, it gives me a lot of, what's the word? It makes me think I'm doing the right thing, you know, because I think you see so many entrepreneurs who are like 18, 19, up until like their early 20s, straight away go and try to make this billion-dollar business and raise all this money and stuff like that. Whereas realistically, they're so unequipped skill-wise to be able to do that. And I think the way you've gone about it is really cool, and I'm really excited to see how you take Lighthouse. I know it's going very well so far, but we'll talk about that in a little bit. I wanted to make a point as well on what you said about treating the business like your own business? Because you were at Datacom for how long? It was only a couple years,
yeah,
wasn't
it? Three years. Thereabouts, three and a half.
Three years and got promoted up that quickly is that's pretty impressive, that's for sure. And I think there's a good learning point in there where it's like, treat it like your own, because most people in a job don't treat it like their own, you know. They go and they do what they have to do. But if you're willing to put in the extra effort, that's what really gets noticed, isn't it?
Yeah, I would say there's sort of two parts to treating it like your own. Obviously, if it's your business, you're no doubt going to put a lot of effort and energy in. I certainly did at Datacom. But I think the other aspect of it is just being very aware of the fact that it is a business. And I think it's one of the things which you get a crash course in when you go to the company's office. You know, you do the easy part, you register the business, and you open a bank account. And then you very quickly realize, even more so when you employ staff, but you realize that that bank account can go to zero, and it's your responsibility to make sure that doesn't happen. And I think in a big corporate environment, you can very easily get isolated from the reality, which is that at the end of the day, yes, there are lots of great things that we're there to do to improve our customers' lives and that sort of thing. But at its core, it is a business, and part of that is keeping the bank balance in the black.
Yeah, 100%. It reminds me a lot of a conversation I was having with one of my mentors, Bill Smale. Not that long ago, because he runs a program at Westlake. We did a podcast last week interviewing some of the applicants of that program called Open Ground, which is all about helping young entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
It's a great episode. Anyone out there, definitely go check it out. But it's all about some of the things we talk about. As he says, you know, every year there's about 30 students that go through it. Not everyone there is going to be an entrepreneur. But still starting your own business, even if it fails, you learn so much about how a business runs and what goes into it. And you become so much more valuable, even if you do decide to take a career in corporate or whatever it may be.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, you touched on it at the start around, you know, there's some people who go out straight away at university and dive straight into the billion-dollar idea, and then there are others who maybe take a bit of time to learn a few core skills before they go and do that. The thing I like about entrepreneurship is there is no cookie cutter. I actually never did entrepreneurship at university, so I'd be interested in what's taught. But I find that everybody I talk to, I speak to lots of other founders, and I'm sure even for you, running this podcast, speak to lots of very interesting people. You can't plot the path. You can't say you do these things, then you can go and start a business. And in my experience, I mean, I've had a great journey. But so much of it I can attribute to luck, particularly in the earlier years. And yes, there's a lot of skill building that now things that sort of feel like second nature. But looking back, you know, I certainly lacked these skills in the past. But I only got there really by, as you say, making a lot of mistakes and kind of fumbling my way to where I am now. It's really how the journey feels, less than being very deliberate. I think there are certainly parts of what you do that are very, very deliberate. I mean, I sort of touched on it a little bit earlier, but I love solving problems. And I think that is the kind of core responsibility of an entrepreneur, is that we're building businesses. And if you're building a business around something, typically you want to make sure there's an audience for it. And that audience is almost universally somebody who's experiencing a problem, and that I would say is probably the most universal skill across all walks of entrepreneurship.
Yeah, 100%, I 100% agree with that. So, I mean, I think that is, when you take it right down to the core, that is what it is, right? It's solving problems in one way or another. So thanks for sharing that. That's a really great insight. Now, the next thing I think we've got to talk about is you were running a 200-person team at Datacom, and then you gave that up to come and do Lighthouse. So talk to us about what made you transition and what Lighthouse is.
Okay, so I mean, maybe we can, what would be useful is if we frame up what Lighthouse is.
Okay.
So Lighthouse is, as you mentioned before, it's a digital conveyancing platform focused on really changing the way that people transact property when we have an ambition to do that globally. But that's a very large problem to solve. And so what we thought we would do, my business partner and I, is start small and really hone in on a problem that my business partner was very close to. He's a lawyer and has run law firms for several decades now, though he won't want me telling you how many decades. And because of his closeness to the problem, he really understood and could see that there was an issue to be solved. So the place we decided to start was in making conveyancing more efficient for lawyers. So for those of you who don't know, conveyancing is the process by which a lawyer supports you in buying or selling a property.
So Simon, so tell me more about how you and Gerard got together to start the problem-solving idea for Lighthouse and what that process was like.
Yeah, certainly. So I would say sort of about 6 months into my time down in Wellington, I got a call from my now business partner, Jared, who'd been practicing law for several decades.
Yep.
Jared and I had met back when I was running Black Software. I'd actually helped him with a tech startup of his own a few years back. And Jared had always been interested, he even spoke to me back then, he'd always been interested in solving what he saw as some kind of core pain points within property transactions. So Jared called me. The time was, I think it was just right for me, mm-hmm. To kind of reignite that entrepreneurial flame. So him and I got together. He sort of said, "Look, Simon, I've got this thing. I'm really keen to do something about the property space." At the time, he'd actually been quite interested in first home buyers and doing something to solve the pain points that they had. So him and I got back together, I suppose you'd call it. He flew down to Wellington and we just spent a weekend, really trying to understand, for me, whether or not there was a business in the space. So we mapped out, conveyancing from a lawyer's perspective, which Jared is, and looked at, the various actors that are involved in a conveyancing transaction, what their role is, what are the types of steps that they're doing, and where does the pain lie throughout that user journey. Nothing special in terms of the way that you approach the problem solving, but the problem itself was really interesting to me. So when Jared and I dug into it, it was fascinating for me as a technologist to see the amounts of sort of manual process that exists within a law office, particularly around a conveyance. So, the perfect candidates for automation, a client name being written out 20 times throughout a transaction, or filling out forms, those kinds of things, which was fascinating for me because obviously you day to day don't get much insight into what happens within a law office, but realizing that yes, there's this sort of pointy end where all the value is created when you're giving advice to a client, but in order to do that part of a transaction, you have to go through all these other quite manual steps. So I got quite excited, and certainly felt, if Jared was telling the truth, that this was going to be revolutionary. So Jared and I decided quite quickly that yes, all well and good that him and I are both quite excited about the problem space, but let's go and validate first that that it's not just him and I at the water cooler getting all excited. So Jared and I went up and down the country and we spoke to law firms, big and small, right from the top down here all the way down to sort of smaller rural practices in the likes of Te Awamutu. Okay. That was really fascinating. So we sort of started the journey by going out to these firms. We had built a little bit of a design prototype, I'll call it, at that point. We would go and speak to the partners of law firms and we'd say, "Look, this is what we're doing. We're going to go and solve conveyancing. What do you think?" And as you can expect, we got answers that were sort of a bit of a brush off, but if you read into them and wanted them to sound positive, they were. Yeah. People would go, "Oh, that looks great. Keep going." and so after a couple of these meetings, Jared and I decided that perhaps we should take a slightly different approach, and we should go and speak to those who are actually doing the work on these property transactions.
Yeah.
And we should stop speaking and start listening. we went back through these firms, and we went to speak to the legal executives that do the sort of grunt work on these property transactions. And we just asked three simple questions. What do you think about conveyancing? What are the pain points to you?
Yeah.
What have you done about those pain points? You know, have you created any kind of automation of your own, that sort of thing?
Yeah.
And then the final question was, are you happy with the solution that you've created? And that simple little formula of what is the pain point, or are there pain points? What have you done about it, and do you like your current solution? Was a goldmine for us.
Really?
Yeah. So we, at that point, we got validation that yes, everybody really did feel some pain points, and there were lots of them. But even more proof for us was when we asked the question of, "Have you tried to solve this in the past?" We were getting yeses, and the solutions were fascinating. Like one of the law firms we spoke to was literally using email signatures as a way to build templates into their workflow. So they'd drop down an email signature and pop up with a little bit of an email drafted for them.
Oh, okay.
And obviously not a perfect solution, but yeah. It shows you that clearly the pain point is compelling enough for someone to try and do, somebody outside technology to try and do something about it themselves.
Absolutely.
So at that point we got really, really excited, and all of this was happening whilst I was at Datacom. In the very early hours of the morning and late on weekends. But we pulled together a bit of a better prototype, let's call it, focusing on a particular part of yep. that problem. And we really went hard at the problem. We put a fair bit of money together between the two of us. We bootstrapped. We got a development team together offshore along with myself. And we built a first working prototype. Or should I say, we were midway through building a first working prototype when ChatGPT exploded onto the scenes.
Yeah.
And we took a little bit of a pivot. But that brings me to my journey towards the end of Datacom. Once we got to the prototype point and we started sharing it with some of these law firms and getting positive feedback, I decided that I was perhaps getting to a tipping point where I couldn't give Datacom my all, or I couldn't give Lighthouse my all.
Yeah.
So I went and raised a bit of capital. I was incredibly blessed to have, let's call it friends and family, but a group of people that really got behind Jared and I and what we were looking to do, and fashioned together enough money that we could employ me full time and keep the development team offshore going.
Yeah.
And that was when sort of switched over to full time at Lighthouse.
Wow. Yeah, that's really interesting to hear, Simon. Thanks so much for sharing that. Just how, you know, a SaaS platform gets founded in those early days, you know, right through the process. And I think, you know, from everything I know, that is the right steps. First of all, good partnership there. Two different sets of skills between you and Jared. Jared's got the industry insight. He knows what lawyers want for the most part, right? And then you've got the technological thing. And I think that's super important in a startup, right? Is having different sets of skills that complement each other.
Totally.
So many people go in with the same sets of skills and then they're just, you know, not really leveraging each other. And then I think, you know, going through that whole problem phase from the start, I'm imagining you probably got a lot of that from when you're doing stuff at Black Software and working through developing other products for other businesses, right? Going through, finding those pain points, working out the automations, and then like getting that niche idea.
Hmm.
And then after that is like market research, right? That is the that is the most important step, finding out, do people actually want it? Are they actually gonna pay for it? Because, you know, you can have a great idea, but if you think it's a great idea and no one else does, it's not really going to be a business, is it?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. It's a really good hobby at that point.
absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you touched on something that I think is really, really important there, which is the relationship between Jared and I. And having done a few business ventures along the way, I can say that towards the end of Black Software, I ran that on my own, so that maybe notwithstanding, but I think that a strong partnership is, for me, has been a huge part of the reason I've been successful in all of the ventures, even though they might not have netted me some big dollar figure out the other side, but I've learned huge amounts from them, and most often that comes from having a contrasting view. And my business partners have almost always been the main source of that. So, yeah, Jared being a lawyer, he's probably an atypical lawyer. He's very outgoing, and he's got lots of ideas, and certainly spends a lot of time challenging me, and likewise I do with him. But it's exactly that, I think, that makes us a successful team and allows us both to kind of, I suppose, keep each other on course.
Yeah,
it's probably a good way to describe it. So your sort of mention of the process we took, it sounds very deliberate, you know, go and ask these three questions. This is how you do product discovery. But I assure you it wasn't. There were all kinds of mistakes. And I think by having somebody else alongside you, it becomes a lot easier to catch those mistakes early.
Yeah.
Or earlier.
Second set of eyes.
Totally.
Accountability.
Yeah, we could have got together in a room and, you know, built a whole product. And we probably could have raised money without talking to customers. And we probably could have got quite far down a journey of building a product. At least that might have looked from the outside like we were building a business. But until you go and you speak to your customers and you really get the true feedback, which is scary, you don't know if there's something there or not.
Yeah. And that was something like I've definitely learned in my entrepreneurial journey, which is nowhere near as long as your one. But I remember when I started, I had a similar thing with the chatbots. You know, I would go and pitch them to my first businesses and my first like potential clients. And I was telling them it's great, it does this, it does that, it does that. But then it wasn't until I actually, you know, managed to get one to give me a try, who I said originally I was going to do it for free, that I realized that there is actually a lot different needs and wants that those businesses actually want out of it. And that's the thing, you don't know until you actually hear it from your customers,
totally.
Right?
Totally. Yeah. I think you're a technologist, clearly, like I am. And I get so excited by new technology. I mean, the AI wave has been super fascinating for the technical part of me. But the most important thing, we sort of mentioned a little bit earlier, but the most important thing in building a business, I think, is just that understanding of a problem and the empathy for the people who are experiencing the problem. Yeah. That's how you build great products. But I will caveat this by saying, you know, this is my experience. So and the journey is not complete, and I don't think it'll ever be complete. That's certainly what I've felt has got us to where we're at today, which is a really exciting position to be in.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. No, that's really cool. So I just want to touch quickly, because I'm not sure we fully covered. Could you explain a little bit better? Oh, sorry, not better.
Better is fine.
Let's explain a little bit more what the product of Lighthouse is, because I know it's changed a bit, like when it originally started to when ChatGPT, and last time we spoke, you told me the story about how Jared was saying the computer can do this and that, and then it was like, computers can't do that until the GPT API came out, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Could you touch on that a little bit?
Yeah, certainly. So Jared is fantastic with vision and how he can imagine a solution. And I remember when Jared and I first got together and we kind of mapped out the problems, and Jared went, this is the vision. The vision is that I come into my office on a Monday morning. The agreement had arrived on the weekend, you know, you buy and sell a property, and an agreement gets sent to your lawyer that kind of allows them to start the process.
Yeah.
He had this vision that it would arrive on the weekend. He would go into the office. He'd open up the system, and the system will have read the agreement, gone and fetched a bunch of documents from Land Online. Just imagine some other online platform. Pulled the documents together, read them, drafted some advice for him, and he had to just press a button and fire it off to a client. And when Jared, I mean, it's interesting now, you know, what this is 18 months later. Now looking back, that sounds reasonable.
Yeah.
But 18 months ago, I thought he was crazy. and I had to ground him often and say, there's no way we can do this. But as it turns out, we can do that, and this goes back to the point of having a great business partner that there's a contrasting idea. So at that time when we were first fashioning this together, as I sort of mentioned before, ChatGPT was released and took the world by craze, certainly took me by craze, into this completely different world of how you could build applications. And suddenly Jared had good cause to tell me that it was possible. and so we got to work trying to do it. And so what we've got now, what we've got today, which is a slightly different solution to what we mapped out on the wall about a year and a half ago, is a platform that can do most of Jared's vision.
Yeah.
It can read the agreement. It can pull key details out. It can create a first draft of advice, which is a lot harder than you would think. If you're used to playing with ChatGPT online, you'd think, just give me some advice in this document. It is not that simple.
Nope.
there's been a lot of work that's gone into getting the details out, organizing them in the right way, and getting a platform to understand what all of this means, or getting an AI application to understand what all this means. So I'm very pleased to say, we've delivered a lot of that vision now, and in the hands of lawyers, the feedback is that we're really doing what we set out to do, and we're sort of on average now, the average transaction that a lawyer puts through the platform with a decent amount of complexity in it, and we're able to save about 45 minutes on that. And to put that in perspective, that's on a transaction that might take 10 to 12 hours. So for an early prototype, it's a pretty good time saving.
Yeah, it's not bad.
Yeah, and on some of the more complex transactions, we're getting feedback now that we're saving over an hour and a half. So that stage that we're at now, it's a really nice place to be, because you get a sense of validation that can feel like it's miles away when you're starting the business. You know, when are we actually going to deliver on this this mission statement that we'd started with of saving lawyers time? And we're at that point now where by no means is it easy, but one of the biggest sort of assumptions we were making has been confirmed. So it's a lovely place to be.
Yeah. Mm. No, it's very cool. I mean, thanks for highlighting that. I know right now, like you said, there's it's that niche problem, and it's already saving lawyers so much time. But I know there's plans in the future to keep expanding on the product, and you know, maybe moving into other areas. Obviously, property conveyancing is quite a large one.
Mm.
Could you talk a little bit about your future plans for Lighthouse and how you see it going in the future?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, that core mission of changing the way that property is transacted, it starts with the lawyer, because the lawyer is such a large actor in the process. And so we get very excited about where things could go longer term. But if I just zero in on what we can see at the moment, if we can continue to deliver more and more time savings, then what that means is that the lawyers can spend more time focusing on the high value part of the transaction, which is interacting with their customers. And freeing up that time is kind of this North Star that we're chasing down. And there's a range of features from more traditional technology like, form filling and online dashboards that give you a pizza tracker, let's call it, of where the transaction is and keeping people informed. There are features that'll reduce some of the risk, as you can imagine. Property transactions are a fantastic target for bad actors. So bringing a lot of the security that you get with the likes of online banking into a space like conveyancing, I think, poses a much better future for the industry from a security perspective. I don't want to say once we're done with it, because I don't think that we'll ever be done with the mission of changing the way that lawyers work on property transactions. But I think there are other parties that are involved, the likes of, insurers or banks or real estate agents, that all play a role in a property transaction. You can sort of imagine it like a conveyor belt.
Yes.
And that in this conveyor belt, somebody does something and then the process sort of moves to the next step and there's another party that might get involved. But these people are continually moving around the conveyor belt and passing it back to one another. And so we're focusing on a particular part of the transaction, the first interaction with the lawyer, sort of right the way through to when a lawyer finishes their work. but there are all sorts of other actors with their own particular problems.
Yeah.
And so we will dive into those problems and begin to tackle them in time. But there's more than enough on our plate for now.
I'm sure. Well, I mean, it sounds like really exciting stuff. You know, it comes back to that problem solving. And like, from what I've seen, to be successful in business, you need to start with that niche product, right? Mm. Because you can, once you niche down, you can solve that better than anyone else, and then you can expand out from there. So yeah, so you had the original Friends, Family, Fools Round, whatever it's called. And that's what got it off the ground, and now you're going through the second seed round, is that right?
Yeah, so I struggled to know exactly what we call the stage that we're in, but I think it's pre-seed.
Okay.
We've raised two rounds from Friends and Family.
Yeah.
And the most recent one, a couple of months back, allowed us to hire a permanent New Zealand staff member alongside me, which is good because it's getting lonely in the basement. So we've raised two rounds of capital, and we've been able to do that because we're showing progress. You know, we started early days. We had some great feedback from users on the problem. We had an early prototype. So we raised our first capital to deliver that prototype to market, the MVP. And then we've now got to a point earlier this year where we've been able to show that there's consistent use from lawyers, and the data is really important at this stage, obviously.
Yeah.
Consistent use from lawyers and verbatim sort of feedback that that we are really saving time.
Yeah.
So that got us to kind of a couple of months ago where we raised another round of capital just off the back of moving to our first paying customers. So that was kind of our next milestone ticked. And we went back to our friends and family and said, look, we really believe we're onto something.
Yeah.
Can we go faster? And as I say, we're blessed to have the support to be able to do so. And now the next stage for us is really prove out that we can keep paying customers, that we can build that number up. We don't want to go too big just yet. We want to keep it to a smaller number of law firms that we can really connect with and understand their experience of using the product. But in doing that, we'll get to a point where we can prove to them that the value is worth the sort of transaction fee that we'll charge.
Yeah.
And if we can show that to our wider investors, then we'll raise a larger round and we'll use that to add more people to the basement, or maybe we'll get an office. We'll see.
Very cool. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. I think it's really cool just to see how fast this business has picked up and grown. And I think like that, a lot of that comes down to, you know, whether it was accidental or, you know, I'm sure there was some intentional things along the way, taking the right steps from the start, right? With the market research, the product development. And now it seems to be going really well. There's a few law firms you're working with, more I'm sure that want to be.
I think just that's a really good point to maybe touch on is that yes, I think we've been the process we've taken at the start particularly was easy to make some mistakes, and we got lucky about the approach we took. We've done things now, so we have law firms that are using the platform, and all of those law firms catch up with us once every 3 weeks, and they give us feedback on their experience with using the platform. We talk to them about new features that we're building. What we've managed to do is reduce our ability to make mistakes down to about 3 weeks, that we can make the wrong decision, but by the time we go and speak to our customers again in 3 weeks' time, they'll tell us. And so that's really what the main focus of our kind of current stage is learn as quickly as possible. Don't be afraid about making mistakes, because they will be small in these circumstances. There are no sort of big scary one-way doors that we need to go through at the moment. And that highly engaged group of law firms that we're working with are sort of instrumental in that. And I think that that's getting to this point where we have that engagement from our customers has been a result of bringing them along the journey with us. At the end of the day, I'm not a lawyer. As I said earlier, I dabbled in law at university for a little while and then realized that I perhaps wasn't smart enough to do that. And now we have customers who really, really understand the problem and understand it far more than Jared and I could ever understand. So being able to speak to them and speak to them regularly and serve them really, really well is, I think, probably one of the largest assets that we have at the moment, is that engaged customer base.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's really interesting for me to hear, and it's been making me think a little bit as you've been speaking. I guess coming back to what you were previously doing with Brand Fiber and Black Software, how does running a SaaS platform compare to running more of a development style business like that? What would you say?
Yeah, I'd say, well, it's completely different. It's scary. it's scary for different reasons. So, if I can sum it up simply for myself, the challenge with a professional services business is that every month you start from zero. You win a project, you deliver the project, maybe you pick up some sort of long tail support work off the back of it, but for the most part, you then got to go out and do the same thing again. Mm-hmm. And that's really, really exciting because you get lots of sort of change in context. And I don't know about you, but I really quite enjoy the sales process. It's lots of fun. It's also sort of problem solving to some degree, but on a different wavelength. Contrasting that to a SaaS business, in my experience, it's all in the hope of this big hockey stick.
Yeah.
I mean, we're burning through money, and we have been burning through money since we started. And, you know, we're very lucky to be at a point where we've built something that customers are willing to pay. But there's a runway before that gets to a point where we're positive from a cash flow perspective. And actually, the model in SaaS is that you never get there, that you push growth, right? Yeah. Until way later down the track. And that's nerve-wracking. But it's scary when you start, and if I look back, it would have been really hard for me to do this back at university. I knew nothing about fundraising, and certainly wasn't as impressive as someone like you. I'm sure you'd be able to raise capital much better than I could have back then.
Oh, I'm not sure, but thank you.
but I think being in a privileged position of having investors who have backed us and believe in the longer term of the idea, and obviously also staff as well that are willing to take that risk and join us. We're now in that position of sort of aiming for the hockey stick at some point down the future. And that's just it's a very different environment to be in. Mm.
Yeah. 100%. And that's something I sort of asked, you know, just cause I wanted to know personally. I think SaaS is a really interesting business model to me, right? Because you're focusing on building that one core product, but then once it's built, effectively, you can sell it as many times as possible, right?
Yeah. I would caveat though by saying that it's never really finished.
True.
I mean, this is one of the fascinating things about what we're doing at the moment. In my mind, is that we're building an application that suits the way that lawyers currently work.
Yeah.
Because we need to build something that lawyers are comfortable moving on to. But once we get to that position, in time, we can start to transform the way that lawyers work. So a good example might be, and I'll oversimplify here, but lawyers send emails.
Yep.
And so what we do is we help a lawyer draft an email. But in time, they don't need to send an email.
No.
This could all be done on a platform, which is what we intend to be. But to get there's a series of steps you have to climb first. We don't want to try and leap, you know, to step five before we've learned to walk. So, yeah, that's it. That's been an interesting part of the journey, but that will continue far into the future. There is no finish line. I think you see it now. I mean, you look at the big FANG companies around the world. They have thousands and thousands of engineers, and I assure you they are not maintaining it. They're building new things, and that's a fascinating part of it, is that, you know, once you solve one problem, there's another one that you can unlock and solve. And I think that's the interesting part that's quite different. Going back to your question before, how do they contrast? I feel like in my sort of small experience in SaaS, you're building layers that you're kind of solving one layer of problems and then you're moving to the next.
Yeah.
Whereas I think in professional services, building IP, you can certainly do it, but it doesn't work quite in the same way. You're not, like I say, that kind of going back to ground zero first of the next month kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. That's really interesting for me to hear, you know, I think it's good to hear about someone who's done it, because SaaS to me is like a really interesting model. And I definitely think one day, whether it's 10 or 20 years from now, whatever it is, it's something I want to explore. It's part of my entrepreneurial journey.
I think so. You'll be great at it. I think. I think you have a lot of empathy, clearly, and you're very engaging to talk to. And certainly from my experience, that's the hard part, is being willing to go and get out in front of people and speak to them about their experiences and understand their problems and then do something about it.
Yeah.
I'd say you got the skills for it.
Thanks. One day, hopefully. But I know for now it's definitely about that learning process, you know, like going through those product developments and, you know, working with more businesses, finding out what they want. I think the way I see it for Wildbot anyway is that, like, it's definitely going to be something where I keep working with businesses, and if I can find, you know, the right niche and they've all got the same problem, then it's like, well, may as well look at starting to develop that. But I don't know when that'll come, so I'm enjoying what I'm doing now with my professional services.
We can all read about it in the Herald one day.
I'm sure. Yeah, but that's an interesting insight to hear, the difference between SaaS and, you know, professional services, since you've been in both. The next thing I want to talk about is, I know you're in the legal space. What are lawyers using AI for right now? Are they using AI? You know, what's that sort of industry insight like? Because I feel like there might be a few possible implications that could go wrong. I don't know. I'm just interested to hear.
Yeah, well, I find it fascinating that, as I'm sure you do, you see so many people in a bubble that are talking about it, and it's kind of all consuming. But then you sort of step out and you speak to somebody who might be sitting in a corporate doing their sort of day job, or in my case, maybe to law firms. It's quite rare to find people that are using it in their day-to-day workflow. And I think that's the important part about getting out and speaking to people, speaking to people outside of that bubble, because you suddenly realize that, hang on, my perspective might be slightly skewed.
Mm-hmm.
So there are certainly law firms that are using AI, the likes of ChatGPT, sure. Adobe's got some interesting products that are quite useful in a similar vein. But my experience with chat interfaces is that they're a really good way to understand what AI is capable of, but they're perhaps not the right way to solve a specific problem.
Absolutely.
And lawyers don't want to, I'm generalizing here a little bit, but I think for the most part, lawyers don't want to go and interact with a chat interface.
Yeah.
They want to solve a problem.
Absolutely.
And so it's kind of the packaging part to some degree of how you integrate that into a workflow or a problem that's really, really important and makes it far more usable. In my experiences, lawyers are definitely willing to use AI because they're using our product. Mm-hmm. I think that it'll be really interesting to see how AI products transform over the next couple of years, because I think we're in a very early stage where the chat interface is really what people know, but I don't think it's what mature products in the space look like.
Mm, absolutely. And I think what you said about being in that bubble where people are talking about AI and technology all the time is something I've definitely experienced, you know?
Yeah.
I think all the time, like, oh, this AI, that AI has to be more advanced, has to be that. And then you speak to someone else who's not involved with that, because in fairness, they've got to live their own life. They've got their own set of tasks to do.
Yeah.
And you think, wow, it is actually really interesting to see where most people are with all this, you know?
Yeah.
And it's interesting. I was even listening on the news the other day where they were interviewing, you know, various people and a politician about AI. And it is really still new to a lot of people. And I think it's going to be interesting to see how it develops, because, like you said, people are used to that chat interface.
Mm.
But that's just the very first thing. There's so many in-depth automations and processes that can be built out of that.
Mm.
But, you know, it's not like AI can just do everything, you know?
Yeah.
It can do a lot,
yeah,
but you need to really be able to set it up right so it can do what you actually need.
Yeah, I think people sort of liken it to the sort of mobile revolution, yeah, right? And I think that's a really good way to characterize it, because it's another tool in your toolbox as somebody, you know, as a software engineer or as an entrepreneur. It's another way of solving a problem, but I remember the craze when everybody had to have a mobile app, And everybody doesn't need a mobile app, right? every business doesn't. So I think, yeah, there's a set of problems that it's really, really good at. And I certainly think it's going to completely change the way that we build software. But the kind of core principles of building of software, I think, again, go back to find the problem and then go look to the solution. Don't grab technology and go looking out for a problem. Technology in search of a problem, I think, is probably a good way to describe what some of the mistakes we can make, I guess are in the AI space at the moment.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a lot of great points to get out of what you just said. I definitely agree. And I'm going to be thinking about it a lot in my own journey. The next thing I wanted to ask is, what would you say is one of the biggest barriers to, let's go with lawyers specifically, adopting AI and using it? Is it just lack of skills, lack of the ability for the current existing products to be able to fix those niche issues? You know, what would you say in your opinion it is?
Yeah, well, let's use the example of a lawyer. I mean, lawyer goes to work and does what they do because they enjoy practicing law and they have a job to do, right? And they enjoy it. And I think that present day chat interfaces might help them a little bit with some things, you know, first draft of a contract or something like that. But for the most part, it's adding work, mm-hmm. and it's not helping them engage with what they're the task at hand properly. And I think this just goes back to the point before where the current interface doesn't lend itself towards solving a problem that a lawyer day-to-day experiences. I'm not sure how AI as a day-to-day tool might help you in your podcasting workflow. You know, if you're really enjoying podcasting, and we said, you know, why aren't you using ChatGPT here? Maybe you use it to draft the script. I'm not sure. But I think that you'd go, well, I enjoy the art of creating this video. And yes, there might be a form factor that AI can be useful for in a scenario like this. But at the moment, it doesn't exist.
Absolutely.
That might be your next SaaS idea. I don't know.
No, that's, I definitely think you're right there. It's like the technology is there. And it's just all these like niche implementations and product problem solving ideas, like we were saying, that are yet to be sort of discovered. You know, from what I've seen is people have varying opinions on AI, a lot of the time based on how well they understand the technology. Some people think, you know, AI is great. It can do this. It can do that. I'm talking just on like a chat interface like ChatGPT. Yeah. And then you've got other people that's like, oh, AI is not that good. It gives wrong answers. It gives this. It gives that.
Yeah.
But it's just because they don't actually know how to use that technology efficiently.
Totally.
And I think it is coming down to other, you know, technologists building those niche problems and implementing the technology correctly in a way where it's actually making sense for them. And in fairness, like, these people don't have time, you know. They're busy doing their own jobs or businesses or whatever it may be. So
I think that the chat interface was really pioneered at OpenAI as what I think a fantastic brochure for the underlying technology, but not meant to be the solution.
Yeah.
And I think that, it's a really good way to broadcast the types of things that you could do with AI. But, I think... where was I going with this? Don't worry about this point.
You were speaking about how, you know, ChatGPT was effectively marketing.
Yeah, totally.
For the GPT's capabilities and.
Yeah, definitely. Well, yeah, definitely. But I think I was just going to make the same point again, really, which is that I think that form factor.
Yeah.
That form factor is really the most important thing. Is, you know, how are you going to build this into a solution rather than let it be the solution?
Yeah.
And to your point, there are plenty of things about AI that. That particularly in a chat interface don't work well. Yes, it hallucinates, right? Mm-hmm. People time and time again use that as an excuse. And yes, it can be, a little silly at times. But make no mistake, we are in very early days from an AI perspective, and yes. And it's just going to get better and better. I think, I mean, at the moment, GPT-4 Omni's probably trained on hardware that's, you know, 2 years old.
Yeah.
And it'll be fascinating because we've seen NVIDIA exploding. Where the hardware goes naturally, you can expect the same kind of exponential output from these large language models in time.
Yeah.
And I think that'll be really interesting for those of us that are trying to solve problems. But
it's great to talk to you about that. I know a lot of the listeners and viewers are definitely like interested to hear a little bit more because it's not something they're immersed in us, right? So it's definitely interesting to talk about and you know, give a bit of insight into why these are sort of what they are and where you see it going in the future.
Yeah, so. Definitely. And I think don't use ChatGPT as your judge for where the technology is even today, because like I say, the chat interface is flawed and there's plenty of things. I mean, we even in our application, lots of work that goes on behind the scenes that solves the problems of hallucination and like so.
Mm. Yeah, very cool. Cool. Well, thanks for sharing that, Simon. We are unfortunately coming to an end on our time, but it's been great to speak with you, talk to you about Lighthouse, what you've been doing. Before we wrap up, I ask this to every entrepreneur guest, and that is, what is one piece of advice you have for young entrepreneurs out there trying to start their own business, run their first venture, maybe especially those who are trying to get into digital and AI, because I know a lot of people are these days, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it's a good question. I would say just get really, 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 really curious about problems, or focus on a problem that you're already very curious about, because the technology is obviously very exciting and very fun, but the rubber hits the road, certainly from a business perspective, when you're solving real problems. And in order to do that, you need to be able to understand them. You need to understand the people who are experiencing them and build solutions that are better than whatever else is out there or that really, really solve that problem.
Yeah, 100%. That's a great piece of advice. If you're out there and you're listening, you're a young entrepreneur, that is the key. It's finding that problem, making sure that it is a problem, making sure that people are going to pay to fix the problem, and then going and building it. Why not? Mm. Well, Simon, thanks so much for joining us today, sharing your journey, your insights. It's been really great to talk to you about AI, Lighthouse, everything alike. Before we wrap up, how can viewers and listeners find out more about you and Lighthouse? What's the best way?
Certainly. You can go ahead and find me on LinkedIn if you need to, but I think head to the Lighthouse domain and have a look at what we're doing there, particularly if you're a lawyer that's practicing conveyancing. That's light-house.co.nz. We haven't yet managed to steal the non-dash version of that URL. But it's been a pleasure. Thank you, Will. This has been fun.
Yeah, it's been great to have you on. So I'll leave links to your LinkedIn and Lighthouse in the description. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe to the Willbot.ai podcast on your favorite podcast platform and leave us a review. Your feedback helps bring more valuable content. If you're interested in how AI can revolutionize your business, check out Willbot.ai for more information on how we can help your business start implementing AI effectively. Stay tuned for our next episode where we'll have another amazing guest. Thanks for listening and see you next time.